Nigeria Radio, bringing Nigerians in diaspora up to speed.
Weekend Nigerian Spirit of Nigeria Radio, bringing Nigerians in diaspora up to speed. And it's that segment of the show which I totally love. So let's read the bio of our person of interest today. Peter Ogu Okwoche is a well-known international broadcaster from Oju. I'm going to ask him if I pronounce that properly. In Benue State, Nigeria. He was born in Jos, the capital of Plateau State in Nigeria, on the 18th of September, 1968. His parents are Oga Okwoche, Nigeria's former ambassador to France, and Chief Mrs. Inori Okwoche. Peter has been in the broadcasting industry since 1992. He had his primary education at Hillcrest School, Jos, Plateau State, from 1974 to 1976, and Demonstration Primary School, Makurdi, Benue State, from 1976 to 1979. His secondary education was at Wesley High School, Otupo, in 1979 to 1981, the British School of Paris, France, 1981 to 1984, and Federal Government College, Enugu, Nigeria, from 1984 to 1985. He then proceeded to the University of Jos, from where he earned a Bachelor of Arts degree in Theatre Arts in 1989. After his youth service in Bauchi, where he worked as a trainer in the state's art council, he returned to Makurdi, where he took up employment as an English teacher at the government girls' secondary school. After teaching for 2 years, Peter moved to Redwe Benue, Makurdi, in 1983 as an announcer. 3 years later, wanting to expand his horizons, Peter moved to Lagos, where he joined one of Nigeria's leading publications, Hints Magazine, in February 1995. At Hints, along with writing for the magazine, he also produced the highly successful radio drama 9 to 5 and also co-produced the magazine's home movies like Millionaires Are Saints. He became features editor for Hints magazine in 2000, but left 2 years later to resume active broadcasting with Silverbird Communications, owners of Rhythm 93.7 FM. While at Rhythm, he presented numerous programs, including The Breakfast Show, Morning Drive. In 2003, Peter moved to Abuja to head Rhythm 94.7. While in Abuja, he raised the profile of the station with his shows and interviews of prominent Nigerians. In 2004, Peter's talents were snapped up by the world's leading broadcasting organization, the British Broadcasting Organization. He moved to London, where he is a regular presenter on the World Service, presenting such flagship programs as Focus on Africa, Network Africa, The World Today, and Fast Track, amongst others. Peter Okwoche is known for his laid-back but probing interviewing style, prizing answers out of his guests that they would rather not have divulged. On a daily basis, he interviews presidents and heads of states, leaders of industries, politicians, and other newsmakers. He constantly travels to different parts of the world to cover events for the BBC. He also recently moderated the 15th quadrennial conference of the United Nations Conference on Trade and Development in Geneva with heads of states from Kenya, Barbados, Antigua and Barbuda, Pakistan, Costa Rica, Guyana, as well as the heads of some top UN bodies like the UNEP, WHO, WTO, UNCTAD, ECHA and UNAIDS, and more. Peter resides in London with his wife, Esami, a teacher and writer, as well as their two children. He speaks 5 languages. He likes sports and music. He's an avid supporter of Arsenal's football club. This Arsenal, I don't know. Are you still on the league, so, Peter?
Hey, leave us alone, man. You know, we're gunners for life. Haven't you heard that?
I heard that all the time. I don't know. You know, you people are diehard, man. You people are Liverpool. I don't understand. You people just don't move. Welcome to the show, Peter. It's great to have you.
Thank you, Yemi. I'm so honored. I mean, you and I go back a long time. Listening to that bio you read, and I'm wondering why you didn't slot yourself in there a long time ago.
I know. But please, okay, so first and foremost, did I get the pronunciation of your hometown correctly?
You said Oju, but I guess that's to do with your Yoruba roots.
Yes.
It's actually Oju.
Oju. Aha.
Yeah, that's that. Yeah.
Yeah, I should have asked those questions ahead of time, but alas, we learned this thing. Then something else that popped. Something else that popped to me was this sandwich education. How, you know, most people start their education in Nigeria and then complete it abroad.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, you, it was in between that they sandwich you in France. I mean, how did you feel about that?
Well, you know, I mean, I didn't really have much of a choice. My dad was a diplomat, so when his posting to Paris ended and we had to come back home. I mean, the idea was to leave us the kids to finish school in Paris and then come back home. But then they thought better of it, and they just wanted us to try and to make sure that we were connected, firmly connected with our Nigerian roots, which, in hindsight, was a really good thing, you know, because it meant we came back, you know, finished secondary school in Nigeria, went to university in Nigeria, and I, in my case, I worked in Nigeria for many, many years, so it was a good thing in the long run.
I can see that. I can see that. So tell me, I mean, how did you go from theater arts? I mean, and this is also, we also know the antics you got up to. I mean, since we were in university together, we were in the same musical band. How did you go from theater arts and singing to broadcasting? First and foremost, to magazine and then, to teaching, then working in a magazine and then broadcasting.
So you know what it was, like, you know, after, I mean, like you said, you and I were in the same band in university, and then when I finished and I went back home after youth service, and I went back home, and there was really nothing to do, you know. Both my parents were educationists, and they believed that teaching would, I was very young when I finished from university. I think I finished before my 21st birthday, and they thought maybe I was a bit brash, and maybe teaching would teach me some patience, which it did.
Imagine.
So I went off. So I got a job teaching at a secondary school, and I was teaching English and literature in English. And I did that for 2 years, and then, you know, one day I was at home having a chat with my dad, and somebody had come to visit him, and my dad and I were having this chat, and this guy now asked me if I had ever worked in radio before, and I said no. And he asked me if I'd like to audition for Radio Benue, which is in my state, Benue State, you know. So I said yes, you know. And so I went there, you know, did an audition for him, didn't hear anything for 6 months. They called me back for another audition, and then right there and then offered me a job. It meant quitting teaching, which, although I really enjoy, I know how much I learned from teaching young kids.
Yes.
At the time, but, you know, I mean, broadcasting, it meant that, you know, I could go back to music, which was always my first love. Even when I was in studying theater arts, you know, I always concentrated on the music side of things. So I went into Radio Benue, you know, as a duty continuity announcer, what we used to call then, that back in the day, and playing a lot of music, and, you know, and very quickly I think I got noticed, because I was just kind of like fresh on radio, you know, fresh on radio. And, you know, I mean, for those who know where Makurdi is, back in the day, it used to be a very small town. And people used to accuse me of being a big fish in a small pond. You know, so I decided to test myself in Lagos. Couldn't get a radio job immediately in Lagos, but found a job with Hint magazine and wrote that job for like 6 years.
Wow.
You know, then went back into radio. Yes, you know, went back into radio, and it also meant that I had worked not only in film but in radio, but in print journalism. So at that time, even though I didn't know it, you know, I was just adding to my journalism career.
Yes, indeed. And well-rounded too, because you had tested out everything, like you said, without your knowing. And of course, since you were a big fish in a little pond, people were listening and noticing, and unbeknownst to you, I mean, now as I'm talking to you, I'm actually seeing you relaxing, reclining on a chair with your colorful socks, and I don't understand why I have that image. Yes, but I mean, so how was working when you moved to radio from media? Was there a large disparity? Was it just a flow?
No, I mean, the thing is, I guess the 3 years I spent in Radio Benue, you know, I mean, I just had the bug. You know, those 3 years, I fell in love with radio. There was nothing else I'd rather do, but when I moved to Lagos, like I said, I applied for a few jobs in India with Lagos, and I refused. Some people actually told me I wasn't good enough. Others said, listen, we would have hired you, but we don't have the space. So when Hints Magazine came, I was very grateful. And at that time, they were going into radio production as well. So it meant I wouldn't be on radio, but I was going to produce radio. As well as writing for the magazine. So it was kind of like the same, and I enjoyed it, and did it for 6 years. Then I heard that Rhythm in Lagos were employing people, and I applied and got the job immediately. And I mean, I'd like to say this story, but when I moved from Hints Magazine to Rhythm, I took a 50% pay cut. Just because I wanted to go. Yes, I did. I took a 50% pay cut just because I wanted to go back into radio. And, you know, all the niceties that Hints gave me. I mean, Hints were giving me an official car. Rhythm were not offering me that. But I just knew that radio was my first love, and I wanted to go back into radio. And when the opportunity came, I took it and worked in Rhythm in Lagos for about a year and a half. Then, after a lot of convincing, I was asked to move to Abuja to go and head the station.
You didn't want to move to Abuja. Why?
Well, because at that time, you know, Lagos was where radio was at.
Yeah.
You know, radio, Lagos was the hub of radio in Nigeria, and you didn't want to move. I mean, while I was in Rhythm, I was in Lagos. I was, you know, competing against people from Cool FM. Mm. You know, they were our biggest rivals, and I was... Yes. I was going to go to Lagos, to Abuja, and then start competing with Radio Nigeria again. I mean, with all due respect.
I know.
But, you know, and I just thought, I didn't want to go. But then I kind of like thought about it again. I had a young family then, and I thought, maybe this is an opportunity to go and do something different and do, you know, grow something. Yeah. And I did that. And it was a project that I thought was going to last maybe 4 or 5 years. Unfortunately, I was only there for about a year and a half before I got my present job. And, you know, so it was an unfulfilled project. But, you know, I mean, I kind of like coached a lot of young people, broadcasters back then. And, you know, I enjoyed it, yeah.
So this is no slights to Nigeria, but in terms of the materials or the equipment that were available to you when you moved from Rhythm to BBC, was that a huge leap?
You know, that's a very interesting question. When I moved from Rhythm to the BBC, well, I mean, Rhythm was already one of the most advanced, let me put it that way, radio stations in Nigeria at the time.
Okay.
You know, and for, you know, there's something that we used to call in radio, we call reels, you know.
Yes.
Back in the day, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, that's what people used to play their music on, their tapes.
Yes.
That you have to, you know, but people will be very surprised to know that when I left Rhythm, we were using computers to play our music.
Yes.
When I joined the BBC, some programs were still being played on reel.
Oh, wow.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And people were still splicing tapes on reel with razor blades and stuff like that.
Oh, my goodness.
So, in a sense, yes, indeed, indeed. I mean, that changed very quickly after I came. I think within a year of me joining the BBC, they had stopped doing it. But I actually saw reel tapes here at the BBC. So, you know, the technology in Nigeria was actually just as good as the technology here. I mean, and these days, you know, we know that you can actually just sit in your room with a microphone and an internet provider, and you've got your radio station. So, yeah, I mean, Nigerian radio stations weren't doing too badly then. Well, they're not doing too badly now. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have issues with them. I'm sure we'll talk about that in a short while. Mm-hmm. But, the only big leap for me was in the sense that rather than broadcasting to a much smaller community. Mm. So even in Lagos at that time, I was broadcasting to maybe 5-6 million people on a daily basis.
Yeah.
You know, but then, you know, moving to the BBC and presenting a program like Network Africa, which was the BBC's prime breakfast show for Africa at the time, you know, I now find myself broadcasting to 100 million people. So I think that was the difference in terms of being a big leap.
Did that affect you in any way personally? As in, was it daunting?
It was daunting, absolutely. It just made me realize that, you know, there was no room for slacking. I just really had to sit up. I mean, when I got my job initially with the BBC, you know, I mean, I'm this guy. My job base, the Guardian newspaper in Nigeria, the advert was in that newspaper, and a friend of mine and my twin brother actually showed it to me, and I applied. So it wasn't as if they just plucked me from anywhere. You know, I applied like every other person.
Mm.
And so when I got the job, you know, you got the job. I had to go to Ghana to do an interview in Ghana. But once I got to Ghana and I saw the caliber of people who had been called for this interview, I didn't believe I was going to get the job, because those people were all more qualified than I was. And that's the truth.
Mm.
You know, and those people, there were people who had worked with international media organizations before, you know, worked with Reuters, Voice of America, even Voice of Nigeria. But you know, I eventually did get the job.
Mm.
So you kind of like have this feeling when you think, oh, there must be something that you're doing really good. You must be really good at what you're doing.
Yes.
But then, and I'll come to the BBC and then realize that there are people who know more about Africa in one little finger than I do in my whole head.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, so I just kind of like knew that there was no time for slacking, that I really had to sit up and learn. And that's what I did. You know, I spent my first, I'm still learning, but, you know, I spent my first 4 or 5 years learning the ropes and doing absolutely anything that was thrown at me. You know, I never shied away from any work whatsoever. I just did everything because I just knew that, you know, there was a lot of catching up to do. And you know, it was daunting. I mean, knowing that rather than broadcasting to 10 million people, I was broadcasting to people all over the world. And you know, from that 100 million when I first joined, you know, now that I've moved to TV, I'm basically broadcasting to 370 million people on a daily basis.
That is mind-blowing.
It is, isn't it?
It's mind-blowing.
But I love it.
I'm sure you do. Because, I mean, if you didn't, you wouldn't be there. But, I mean, broadcasting, I think it comes in the blood. For somebody who walks in and hears you talking to your dad and asks you if you have ever worked in radio, he obviously saw something or heard something in your voice, the quality of your voice, that was like, this guy,
I'm eternally grateful to Mr. Joel G. That was his name. I mean, sadly, he passed away a few years ago, but eternally grateful to him. He was a brilliant broadcaster as well, and he just had a knack for this thing. I wasn't the only person who he picked. He picked quite a few of us for that station, and, you know, some of us are still working in media. Others have gone into politics. But, you know, I mean, he picked quite a bunch of people, and we're all eternally grateful to him.
What would you say is the most intriguing part of your work? What is it that is most exhilarating?
You know, and for me, it's a whole series of events. Okay. You know, it's a whole series of events. So, you know, for the past, I keep on telling people, for the past 29 years, you know, I've been somebody who wakes up at 3:30 in the morning because I need to listen to the daily editions of whatever news station I'm listening to.
Okay.
You know, because that sets the agenda for me.
Okay.
You know, then I already have in my head, okay, these are the big stories for today. So I already go into the office in the morning, and I've been doing this since I was working in Radio Benue. You know, so in Radio Benue, for instance, while I was, you know, an announcer, I used to go and sit in the newsroom and make sure that I know exactly what stories are coming to me in the studio. And if there were some ways that they wrote, everybody speaks in a different way. So if there were some ways that they wrote their stories that didn't sit well with me, I'll say, listen, we can say exactly the same thing, but writing it this way, which is a bit more comfortable for me to read.
Yeah.
You know, and I've been doing that since the beginning of my career, and there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. And I think most people who work in the newsroom understand that and will not take any offense to it.
Mm.
So, you know, that whole process of getting the news ready, I mean, now I am part of the newsroom, because at the BBC it's a bit different from in Nigeria, where in Nigeria the newsroom writes the news and comes and gives it to the announcer, the newsreader. Here, the newsreader is part of the newsroom. You're part of the writing process as well. You know, in fact, these days nobody writes my news for me. You know, I write all my cues myself. And people just tell me what the story is, yes, what the details are. Mm-hmm. You know, you write it on your own piece. You share your own thoughts with me, and then I write it myself. Mm-hmm. You know, so that whole process from the editorial meeting in the morning to all the debates, and sometimes they're very strongly voiced debates. Yes. You know, not arguments but debates. You know, and then to the news. I mean, you know, almost reading it on air is almost the anticlimax for me, if you like. Yes. So it's that whole journey, it's the whole process, and you know, every day it's a different story. Well, some stories continue,
yes,
but after a while they fizzle out, and then there's a new story that comes up, and then there's a breaking story. Breaking stories are fantastic because they put you on the edge.
Yeah.
So you know, I love everything. You know, and I consider myself a storyteller. So I listen to people's stories and I tell the stories out to the rest of the world, and you know, I just love it. I love it. It's never about me. That's one thing I like about what I do now, the kind of journalism I do now. Whereas when I was working in Nigeria as, yes, not only a newsreader but also as you know, a presenter on the breakfast show or something, you know, so your opinion counts. I mean, they're two different kinds of things, but yes, in what I'm doing now, my opinion doesn't come into it. It's, mm-hmm, never about me. It's about the story. It's, mm-hmm, about the people. It's about the subject. Mm. Never about me, and I absolutely love it.
Wow. There was a thought forming in my head as you were speaking, and what I wanted to say was, you make news sound quite interesting. Maybe that's because I've always run away from the news, because I've always thought, I've always thought it was a bit stoic. But, I mean, if, yeah, one is now involved in the process from beginning to the end, then I guess one is part of the news. And then showcasing that subject to the best of its not ability, but I think you understand what I'm saying. And diminishing...
Yeah, showcasing it,
go ahead,
in its entirety.
Yes.
Yeah, showcasing it in its entirety. You know, but, you know the same way they say that they're always... two sides to the story.
Yes.
There are more than two sides to the story. So my job is to make sure that you see every single side of the story. You know, so sometimes people accuse the BBC of being a bit too anti-Africa or anti this. And I say, listen, if I'm telling you a story about corruption,
yes,
on the African continent right now, and I say a government official has been accused of corruption. Now, if I tell you the story like that, so-and-so person has been accused of corruption and the person is said to have stolen X amount of money.
Yeah.
And I leave it at that, then I have not done my story.
Mm.
You know, I've not done justice to that story. I have to go and look for that person who's been accused and get the person's point of view.
Yes.
Because now, if I go and meet the person and the person refuses to answer me,
yes,
I can still put in my story that the person has been contacted by me and the person has refused to answer, the person has not responded as of yet.
Yes.
Now I've done my due diligence.
Yes.
You know, so even in telling tragic stories, even in telling stories of doom and gloom and famine and war, there's you know, I'm not trying to sound sadistic,
yes,
but there's a sense, there's an art to it. There's a certain enjoyment that you derive by knowing that you have told people what happened.
Mm.
You know, no matter how sad it is. You know, and sad news is, you know, and people say bad news is good news because that's what sells.
Yeah.
But it also depends on how you tell it. You know, sometimes you have to tell, as gory as a story might be, you have to tell it with some element of taste. You have to tell it with some element of guile. You know, you have to be sensible about the way you tell the stories. And, you know, it's a constant work in progress. You know, we do it all the time, every single day. You won't believe how much time we spend debating a story that won't take us more than 5 minutes to do on air. We can spend a whole hour,
wow,
talking about that story. And, in fact, there are some stories that I go into the office at 10 o'clock in the morning and we're arguing about how we're going to tell this story and we're going on air at 6 o'clock in the evening, and at 4 we're still arguing about that story.
Wow.
And at 5 o'clock we decide to drop the story and not do the story again at all.
Oh my goodness.
Absolutely. You know, I mean, it's a daily thing, but you know, you've got to look at every single side of the coin. I mean, in my team now, for instance, you know, I'm one of the more experienced ones.
Yes.
On my team.
Yes.
You know, but that doesn't mean that I get to have my way every day. Absolutely not.
True.
Absolutely not. No.
Very true. Because everybody, like you rightly said, everybody has a point of view, and that is important to hear. Even if one doesn't agree, it is important for one to hear it. So, yeah. Who was the first president that you interviewed, and did you have butterflies in your tummy?
Let me see. Who was the first big name that I mean, it has to be in Nigeria, you know. I mean, while I was still working in rhythm in Nigeria. Mm-hmm. So by the time I moved to Abuja, I was now doing a bit more serious interviews and not just artists and, you know, entertainers and stuff. I mean, the first big artist that I actually interviewed that gave me butterflies has to be Ginuwine, the R&B singer.
Oh
yeah, I mean he was in Lagos at some time, and I interviewed him, and you know, I was working on cloud nine for like 12 months, and I kept on telling people, "Oh, please change my name, you know, change my name from Peter to Ginuwine's friend."
Oh my goodness!
but I think the first major newsmaker that I interviewed that even I was impressed by the interview had to be Malam El Rufai, who is now governor of Kaduna State. At that time, he was the minister for the FCT.
Yes.
So I interviewed him then, and he's, you know, I mean, for all intents and purposes, no matter what people say about him, he's a very intelligent man, and he gave as good as he gets, and that's all I can ask for, you know. And people say, "Oh, why did you ask this question?" Well, you know, I asked the question, the way he answered it, it depends on how he wants to answer it, exactly. You know, and I keep on reminding people that the man didn't make a first class in university for no reason.
Hello.
But since then, I've gone to interview some really difficult people, you know. So you talk to the president of Uganda, for instance, Yoweri Museveni, who's a very intimidating person. And if you're not careful, you get intimidated by him. Wow. Happy to say that I didn't get intimidated. I always wear my colorful socks. They make me happy. You know, I call them my work rags. You know, they make me happy. Colorful socks make me happy. You know, I call them my socks appeal.
I like that.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how do you keep it together when you're interviewing people like that?
Sorry?
How do you keep it together? How do you not get intimidated by people who you walk in the door and is like, "Oh my gosh, my stomach is on the floor"?
So the thing about it is, you know, I always look at it as, if the interview is not for me, the questions I'm asking, so if it's a politician, for instance, the question I'm asking, they're not for me. I keep on saying that the questions are from that woman on the street who's selling tomato or selling pepper, but doesn't have access to you. I'm asking this question on her behalf, you know, or that school, that child who cannot go to school. I'm asking this question on their behalf. You know, I mean, sometimes when I interview Hollywood stars, for instance, you know, I mean, you get that buzz. You know, like, I interviewed a few years ago, I interviewed David Oyelowo.
Yes.
You know, and I was back. I can't believe it, man. I mean, this guy, Selma, I actually have him in the studio with me. I mean, I was like, you know, dude, man, you know, you're like, gosh, man, you're a big star. I mean, it's like, "Peter, what are you talking about? I watch you all the time. You know, I want to be like you when I grow up."
Okay,
and then you that. And then the late Secretary General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan. I interviewed him once, and he was with the rock singer Bob Geldof of Band Aid, and he was telling Bob Geldof, "Hey, Bob, do you know this guy?" And Bob Geldof was like, "I don't know him." He said, "What? You mean you don't? Well, I mean, what exactly do you watch? You mean you don't know this guy?"
Oh,
you know,
goodness.
So at times like that, you feel a bit proud. Mm. You know, some kind of pride that Kofi Annan endorses you. I mean, so sadly, he's passed away recently as well. But yeah, I think over the course of the last, 17 years, I must have interviewed, I don't know, maybe 20 heads of states and presidents. And I mean, I just spent a whole week with a group of them, some online, some in person in Geneva, you know, at the UNCTAD quadrennial conference. Yeah. So, you know, the people, so I think I've interviewed them enough to know that they're not really scary people. They're just ordinary people who happen to be presidents. And, you know, you can get under their skin as well. And I like to do that to politicians, to get under their skin, because, you know, they should be answerable to the people who put them in those positions.
Sure. Very true. So how did you develop your, or how did you hone your skill in your laid-back approach to asking or to interviewing people? A lot of people feel that when you interview people who are prominent or big, they should be very, stiff. Stiff is not the right word, but I think you understand what I mean.
Abrasive.
Yes.
I think abrasive.
Yes.
Like you need to be abrasive with the people you're interviewing. Now, the truth about it is that if you listen to two people shouting at each other, you really can't get anything out of it.
Very true.
You know? So it's all about having the confidence and doing the research. You know, I do a lot of research. A lot of research. In 2 weeks now, I'm off to the climate change conference in Glasgow. I'll be covering it over the period of the conference. It's going to last for 2 weeks.
Okay.
Now, I already have a list of presidents that I'm going to be interviewing, and heads of states and heads of government that I'm going to be interviewing. Each of them, by the time I interview each of them, it's going to be about, their interviews will probably go on air and last about 4 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But by the time I get there, I'll have 10 pages worth of research on each person and their attitude to climate change. So I know very well that there is no angle where these guys are going to escape from me. Now, if you know you have that kind of knowledge in you, why do you need to go and shout?
Very true.
You know, I mean, there's a quiet attitude that you can have when you're having these interviews with these big people, which actually makes more of an impact, you know, because you're deliberate in your questioning. Now, I'm not meek when I'm asking them. You know, I don't say, oh, hello, sir, I'm sorry, sir, can you answer? No, I'm not meek, but I'm deliberate in my asking of the questions.
Yeah.
I am. If I ask a question, excuse me, and you don't answer the question, and you go off on a tangent, saying something else, you know, sometimes I let you talk and then bring you back and say, thank you for that, but you still haven't answered my question. And it's an art to it. I'm not saying everybody has to do their interviews that way. It's just a style. That's my style. I feel that it would be very disrespectful of me to start shouting at the head of state.
True.
Who has been duly elected, you know, who am I to shout at that kind of person? I mean, my job is to hold him to account, but it's not my job to go and shout at him and yell at him and say, no, answer this question, you have not answered the question, da-da. I don't think it works that way. And I think at the end of it, there's a mutual respect that comes out of it. I mean, I'll give you a typical example. So I've interviewed President Buhari, I think, on four different occasions. The first time he was still contesting then.
Yeah.
The second time it was at that meeting that he had at Chatham House just after the elections in 2015 were postponed.
Okay.
Then the third time was 3 days after he won the election.
Okay.
You know, and at this time now, gradually my questions were getting tougher because, you know, now you're the candidate. Before you were not the candidate, then you were the candidate, then you won the election. My questions were getting tougher. Then the last time was after he won the elections here, and then he was here in London, and it was at the Nigeria House. You know, and I went there and I interviewed him, and, you know, I was pretty laid back. He was pretty laid back, you know, and we were talking, and I interviewed him for about 10-15 minutes. you know, and I asked him some really tough questions, even though I admitted that I asked him some really tough questions. And at the end of the interview, I said, thank you very much for your time, Mr. President. It's much appreciated. And he goes, well, thank you very much for your time, Peter, and for your very tough questions. And, you know, that bit that he said about thank you very much for your time and your tough questions, Peter. The BBC now took that bit. I mean, it was a TV interview. We took that bit, and that was the bit that we used to trail the interview. Mm. You know, and both of us laughed about it when he said it. But, you know, he was serious. Mm. He was serious because he knew I'd given him a grilling. But there was no need for animosity because I was polite. I was, you know, I was deliberate, but I was polite. And I think that's just my style. And over the years, it's just stuck with me.
Hmm. I guess when people know that they're coming, they're going to be interviewed by a broadcaster who knows their onions, who has done his work or research on them, then they also come prepared knowing that he's not going to fight me over the questions he's going to ask me.
No,
he's just going to probe until he gets the answers. So I might as well just align.
That's it, you know. And you know, I mean, I've had people who last minute have dropped out of the interview when they realize that I'm the one interviewing them.
Oh my gosh.
I've also had, it's happened. It happens to me all the time. You know, it happens all the time. It's not even a good thing. You know, I've had people who, you know, politicians who've insisted that I ask them, I send them the questions.
Questions ahead.
And I say no. I'm afraid I can't send you my questions ahead because even I don't know the questions.
Mm-hmm.
And then what they will now say, okay, tell us the general area where we're going to talk about. And I think that's fair enough. So I'll send you the general area. But you see, when I'm preparing for an interview, I think I might have one or two questions written down. But after that, it just depends on what your answers are. So I can't send them to you because I don't know what your answers will be.
True. Very true. And then also being that you're coming for an interview and you are the head of an organization, a nation, or you should have vast knowledge at your disposal. You should be able to answer whatever question is thrown your way. Unless, of course, you're not the one doing the work yourself. Then that becomes a challenge.
Well, let me not comment on that.
No, I think you should hold your peace on that one.
Yes.
So I know that, or rather, I believe that you were the one who initiated there was a service, was it a particular language service or a pigeon service that you started with the BBC, that you initiated with the BBC in Nigeria?
No, I didn't quite initiate it. So between 2017 and 2018, the BBC got a rather large tranche of money from the government here and decided to open new services.
Okay.
So they opened six new services in Africa. Three of them were for Ethiopia, so Tigray, Amharic, and Oromo.
Okay.
And then another three in Nigeria, so Pidgin, Yoruba, and Igbo.
Mm.
So to join the Hausa, BBC Hausa is one of the most successful language services that the BBC has been, and it's been here for over 50 years now, I think. So when they mooted the idea, my colleague, Bilkisu Labaran, she was asked to put the BBC Pidgin together, you know, from scratch.
Yeah.
And she now worked on recruitment, you know, hiring and training and establishing a bigger office hub in Lagos and all that. And then after a while, the BBC now decided to start off BBC Igbo and BBC Yoruba.
Mm.
And Bilkisu was also, you know, asked to set that up. In the meantime, she had asked me to come and help her work on BBC Pidgin.
Yeah.
And I did that for a bit, not for too long, I think for about a month or so. And then when she couldn't continue with setting up BBC Igbo and BBC Yoruba because of, you know, other work commitments and family commitments, I was asked to take over from her. So I now, you know, set up the training and got all the trainers together from London here to come to Nigeria and train them. And it meant me being in Nigeria for 6 months, making sure that everything was ready until they all took off and all went live. So after they went live, I spent another month with them, and then eventually handed it over to their boss now, and you know, came back to my primary job.
So in this, your primary job, as you have said over the course of the interview, you have to have knowledge of quite a few working parts. So I mean, I'm thinking in my head now, I mean, this is, you do programming in news, you did radio, you do TV, you do interviews, and now you're sent to, you know what, take the BBC with you and put it inside, but don't do it in English, do it in another language. And make sure that
absolutely, and do it in two languages that you don't speak.
In fact, I was going to ask you that these five languages that you speak, are they part of these languages that you set up?
No, they're not. Not at all. You know, I have a basic understanding of Igbo, and when I say that, I say it with a lot of yes, with a pinch of salt, because it's not as if I have a working understanding of Igbo, but you know, it's not the same thing as writing it and publishing it and having a website in Igbo and doing interviews in Igbo and all that, you know. So we've got professors in Igbo and Yoruba to come and help us when we're setting up. You know, I mean, obviously the teams that we set up for both of them were teams that, you know, speak, write, and read in Igbo.
Yes.
But then we got professors to come and make sure that, because, you know, sometimes even in our languages, there's not a standardized written form.
Yes.
So to come and help us get something, we just needed to start first, and we know that eventually, even with Pidgin, it's the same thing. There was no standardized Pidgin. There's no Pidgin dictionary, you know, and Pidgin is spoken by almost 400 million people across the West African subregion, you know, and it's all different, you know. So in Sierra Leone, Pidgin, their Creole is different from Ghana, it's different from Nigeria, it's different from Cameroon, it's different from Gabon, it's different from Equatorial Guinea, you know. So even within Nigeria, I mean, for instance, Warri Pidgin is not the same as Pidgin in Kaduna or Pidgin in Makurdi.
Sure.
So we had to agree on some kind of standardized version that everybody could understand. You know, and that's what we're working with now. It's caused a lot of consternation amongst people saying, oh, this is not pure and all that. Mm-hmm. And we're like, well, you know, let's start somewhere first. You know, we will revisit it if there's a need to revisit it. We're not saying that we are the guardians of these languages.
Yes.
Yeah, the languages, that we know the languages more than any other person. We're just saying, let's put it out there first. You know, I mean, for BBC Pidgin to exist, I mean, I remember in its first week or in its second week, I mean, they had this very crazy story that not only traveled on the African continent, but traveled, people were responding to it from Canada, from the US, from Malaysia. We said, yes, that's exactly what we want people to know, that this language exists.
Yes.
You know, let's put it out there first. And it's the same with Yoruba and Igbo. I mean, if you take the instance of Igbo now, you know, according to the United Nations, and this is not the BBC, this is the United Nations, Igbo is a dying language.
Really?
Yes, it is. It's a dying language. You know, so for the BBC to now, you know, the BBC to come out with BBC Igbo, we're just doing our own little bit to make sure that we're preserving this language for future generations, you know, and that's what it is. So, yes.
I was going to say that in to align with that, I mean, English is spoken all over the world, but people speak English differently as well. So, I mean, the closest ones are the British and the American English. But then again, everybody else speaks English, but they speak it how they understand it.
Absolutely. And, you know, it's a very funny thing that you say, because I remember when I was a kid and I was growing up in France,
yes,
for instance, you know, and I mean, in France, I went to an English school in France, so my teachers would ask me, what kind of English do you speak in Nigeria?
Mm.
And I would say, well, we speak Pidgin English. And they would say, can you speak it? And I'll say, yes, I can speak it. They say, can you speak it for us? I'll say, no. You know, so it was almost as if I was ashamed of it. You know, because then, I mean, people who spoke, you're probably just about old enough to know that back then, people who spoke Pidgin English were uneducated people.
Yes.
You know, were considered uneducated.
Yes.
Now, I kind of left, went with that mentality. And even while I was there, both my kids were born in Nigeria. I mean, they left very young. Mm. My daughter left when she was 9 years old. But I, even before I had them, I kept on saying, my kids would never speak Pidgin English.
Mm.
You know, and I say that with so much shame now. Because here I am, and my daughter, who is now, who will be 17 in a few weeks,
mm.
is saying, I want to learn Pidgin English. And I wish you could speak Pidgin English.
Mm.
Because Pidgin English, whether we like it or not, is now global. I mean, it's not through the BBC, but through our music, through our Nollywood, you know. It's now become a subculture for even people who are not Nigerians and are not even Africans. You know? So, the English we speak in Nigeria is not the same English that we speak in the UK or in America.
Yes.
I remember when I joined the BBC and there was a word, I can't remember what word it was, and I was asking my boss, hey boss, how do I pronounce this word? And he said, pronounce it any way you like. And I was like, what? This is the BBC. And he said, yeah, boy, yeah, you know, but if I pronounce it in the right way and you don't get the right accent, how does that help you?
Exactly.
You know, just pronounce it the way you want. You know, I don't agree with that completely. I think, if you're speaking English, you should speak it well. I was telling you about the problem that I had with radio stations in Nigeria and TV stations, you know, where everybody wants to speak with a foreign accent. You know?
And then so even people half who of are the spoken, words there, we can't understand half of the words that are being spoken.
Well, there you go. You know, even people who spent 2 weeks in Dubai are speaking with an American accent. But it's true. It's true, and you wonder where did you get this from?
Yes.
And you know what I always say? You know what I always say is that good English doesn't have an accent.
It doesn't. I agree with you.
It does not have an accent. You know, so if you come and you start speaking with some American accent, or you have a Cockney accent,
mm.
and Cockney is not good English.
Mm.
Cockney is just slang.
Yes.
Cockney is the same as Pidgin.
Yes.
You know, so good English doesn't have an accent. That's what I believe.
No,
you know, so if you want to say the word imperial, for instance, you know, anywhere you speak good English in the world, imperial is imperial. It's not imperial. It's not imperial. It's not imperial. You know, I mean, it is what it is. And that's what I keep on telling people. Now, sometimes you have an American pronunciation and sometimes you have a British pronunciation and you might have a Nigerian pronunciation. I agree with that. But there is a standard pronunciation and that's what you should strive for.
Sure.
Yeah.
I agree with you. I know I have been asked severally, were you born and brought up abroad? I said, no, my father just sent me to good schools. And they're like, but you know, you speak English. I said, no, I don't speak with an accent. I just speak English properly. There's a difference.
That's right.
I'm like, are you serious? I mean,
I've had a lot of people who've asked me, Peter, did you, what accent do you have? Do you have a British accent or do you have an American accent or do you have a Nigerian accent? Or I said, if you're hearing any accent from me, that means you're listening with an accent because I am not speaking with an accent.
Nice one.
True. Yeah, you're listening with an accent. I don't have an accent.
I'm going to borrow that line, honestly. That is so cool. You're listening with an accent. That is so, so cool.
Yeah.
So tell me about this moderating of these conferences. I mean, so in my head, I'm thinking, Lord, I'm standing on a platform and they're heads of states from God knows how many countries and presidents, and I'm like, I'm on tender hooks. I'm thinking I must not make a mistake. This must be kind of like working with the BBC for you now. Or do you still get the butterflies in your stomach when you get the office to do stuff, to moderate programs like this?
So, you know, the thing about this is that, right, why this is a bit different and a bit stranger.
Mm.
Is the fact that, so for this conference that I was in recently,
yes,
I mean, these people have been planning this conference for the past 2 years.
Okay.
you know, and then at the last minute, they have to give it to me, an outsider, to deliver for them.
Okay.
You know, and I mean, there's a lot of pushback and there's a lot of trepidation. But I just go there with the confidence that I have done all my research. I have done every possible bit of research that I can do ahead of this event, you know, and that there's nothing that is going to floor me. Excuse me. Sorry, can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
Sorry. There's nothing that's going to floor me. And I just go in there knowing that I've done everything possible. And at the end, invariably, it always turns out that the people are happy with what I've done. I mean, at this last one, you know, I had heads of states, even when they were having their ministerial meetings, when I wasn't there, you know, I hear that some prime ministers were actually quoting some of the stuff that I said, some of the info that I gave. You know, that's a testament to the amount of research that I have done. You know? And I think once you, it's just like preparing for an exam. You know, you prepare very well for an exam. You enter in there with an air of confidence.
Yes.
It's only when you don't prepare that, well, you know, that you know that, okay, there's going to be some car crash moment there. But if you prepare, I think you'll be fine. And for me, preparation is key. You know, once you prepare well, you know, I don't, even if it's a 5-minute program that I have on air, I'm always very well prepared for it. You know, I try to prepare as much as I can. Because I tell you where this preparation thing comes preparation thing comes from. When I was in radio, when I was in Rhythm in Abuja,
yes,
there was a program, a live interview program, a 1-hour program, and somebody they had another presenter, Viewpoint.
Yes.
And on this particular day, you know, without any prior knowledge or information, the presenter didn't turn up. Now, we had the guests were already in the studio. We were like 30 minutes to the program. The guests were already in the station. And the office in Abuja then was, you know, I mean, even getting there was a miracle. You know? And these guys were Americans who were coming to set up a blood bank a series of blood banks in Nigeria.
Yeah.
Starting from Abuja. And so my boss now said, "Hey, Peter, man, listen, this guy is not coming. He's not picking up his phone. So you are going to do this interview." Now, at the point he told me, I was on air presenting a different program.
Yes.
So he came and he talked to me and said, you know, present for me. I said, "Oh, okay, don't worry, I'll do it, man. How difficult can it be to talk about blood?" You know?
Yes.
So 25 minutes later, I finished my program, and then immediately these guys are ushered in. Three of them are ushered into the studio. And, you know, they tell me their names, I write down their names, you know, I said they're going to set up a blood bank and all that. And in my mind, I'm just like, blood. Ah, Peter, how difficult can blood be? You talk about blood, don't worry. And it's an hour interview.
Yes.
With only one break for adverts at the bottom of the hour. So this guy is coming. I introduced the program. Viewpoint, welcome to Viewpoint. You know, I've got so and so guests here with me. They're from America. They've come to set up a blood bank and all that. I can't remember what the first question was, but I asked them the first question, asked them the second question, and then asked them the third question. Now, by the time I finished asking the third question, when they were answering the third question, only 7 minutes had gone.
Oh my gosh.
Only 7 minutes had gone, and I had run out of questions.
Oh my gosh.
So I spent the remaining 53 seconds on that program in excruciating psychological pain.
Wow.
With absolutely nothing to say to these Americans. I mean, till today, only God knows what impression those guys have of me. They must say this is some half-baked presenter somewhere. You know, and after that day, I told myself never again. And you know the interview, the BBC job interview that I went to in Ghana that I told you about?
Yes.
I gave them this example as well. And I said, because of that, I'm always well prepared now. I vowed to myself that that would never, ever happen to me again. What I should have done when my boss said, go and do the interview, how difficult can it be to talk about blood? I should have said, no, boss. Let them go away and come back another day.
Yeah, so that you'd have done justice.
When I've done my research. Absolutely. We survived it. Well, I hope we did. But, you know, the remaining 53 minutes is a complete blur. So So, wow. Yeah, I thought to myself, never again.
I think you just answered the question I was going to ask about anyone who wants to come into broadcasting or who thinks that they have a flair for broadcasting. They have to look beyond the fame, in quote, that they're going to get.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I've never seen myself as, I mean, the fame bit of it, I couldn't care less. I mean, I'm kind of like happy in some other countries. So in places like Ghana, in South Africa, in Gambia, you know, I might get recognized. I mean, I just came through Ethiopia, through Addis, and I was sitting at the airport, and you know, somebody walked past, and I could tell that he recognized me because he, you know, he smiled, he said hello, and then he started whispering to somebody else. But I mean, that part of it is rubbish. I mean, all that without any substance, it doesn't mean anything for me. For me, preparation and integrity. Integrity. You know, we have this whole thing about the brown envelope syndrome in Nigeria. Yes. I keep on telling people, the thing you collect a brown envelope from some politician to do an interview, you stop being a politician, you stop being a journalist.
Yes.
Yeah, people say yes, it's because you paid your salary. I'm like, well, I actually I worked in Nigeria for 12 years as well. You know, so don't think that I just woke up one day and started working at the BBC.
I agree.
You know, so integrity and preparation. And you're halfway there already.
And that integrity is something that needs to be stressed, because, I mean, I have worked in radio in Nigeria as well, and I totally, in fact, I left my job because I couldn't do that. I could not do the brown envelope syndrome. There was no way. It was just, I just kept on remembering going back home, and my father would be like, okay, so they paid you, and I'd be like, no, actually, the person that I interviewed, I didn't even know how I was going to have that conversation. So it stopped me short, and I'm like, no, this is not happening. I can't do this. I cannot do this.
I totally get that.
So tell me, as we wind down, what do you do for fun aside from your football avid loving
club? Well, you know, I love my Arsenal. You know, I've followed Arsenal since 1989. So
you gotta be kidding me!
It's been a long, no, since 1989. You know, even before Kanu Nwankwo joined Arsenal. So I'm one of those guys.
Wow!
And you know, it's been a very hurtful, at times delightful, long love affair that we've had together, but you know, we're still there. But apart from that, you know what, I spend a lot, an inordinately huge amount of time with my kids, because a few years ago, when you know, when they just at the point when they start growing up so rapidly, you now realize that really, I mean, in a few years now, they'll be out of the house and be doing their own thing. And you know, my son has just started uni, and so it's only me and his, you know, my wife and my daughter are home now. So I spend a lot of time with them. I like to, you know, find time to drink some fine wine sometimes, but really, nothing much. You know, I mean, I've never been big on parties and never been big on going out and stuff like that, you know. So it's either the stadium or in my house, or I'm just doing some research. I love listening to the radio as well.
You must. By now, if you have not done what it is for listening to the radio, there will be a challenge.
You know, there's something wrong with me, isn't there?
Yes. What's your favorite food?
Ah, you know, I'd like to see Panajama and Dikaiko. My wife is from Calabar. Yeah, but these days I kind of like limit myself on it because, you know, I mean, you can't afford to get to it. Yes. It's a real thing, people. It's a real thing.
Tell me about it. I like that.
Yeah.
No, I do love pounded yam as well. And I love soups from the Calabar region. I mean, it doesn't matter what soup it is. It's amazing how blessed we are with our foods in Nigeria, especially.
Absolutely.
Even Africa. It's truly amazing.
It is. So I'm a bit of a foodie. I've got a few food series on foods, you know, from different parts of the continent, but you know,
I need to go and look for those and watch them.
I can send you that link and you can put it up.
Please, because I love food. I mean, while I may not look like it, I can, if you leave me our food, we'll be chummies for the rest of our lives. Honestly. Peter, I'd like to thank you for spending the last hour with us. Sadly, it has come to an end, but I mean, I am going to definitely, just like this, your Geneva conferences and things, I'm going to be catching up with you in a few years, and we're going to revisit this interview. Hopefully by then, I mean, let me ask this question. Where do you see yourself, and I hate asking this question, because sometimes I'm thinking, you know, life is just a day-to-day. But what do you see for yourself in the next maybe few years?
So, you know, that's very interesting. You know how I told you that I ran away from teaching into broadcasting?
Yes.
My ideal would be to go back into teaching.
Oh. With the same subjects?
No, no, no. This time it would be more about mentoring people and, you know, in broadcasting ethics and broadcasting, but mentoring people generally, you know. I do a bit of mentoring here, and I would love to go back into it full time. So full circle.
I think that would be actually, I mean, you have a lot to offer. You have a lot of knowledge and experience to share, and it would help tremendously. Especially in the broadcast industry that we have now in Nigeria. Let me not talk about anywhere else. We need that guidance. Yeah. We need that guidance.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
All right, Peter, I'm going to let you go. Thank you so much for spending the last hour with us. My love to your wife and daughter. And I trust you'll have a really restful rest of your Saturday. Do you have any Arsenal match coming up today?
No, not this weekend. Sadly. No, not at all.
Okay. Enjoy some music and some fine wine then.
Thank you very much, and I do appreciate it. And you have a lovely weekend. And Yemi, it's been great, you know, talking to you. Like I said, we go back a long
way. We do. And I will definitely be catching up with you now and then again.
Okay, no problem at all. All the best.
And to you too. Thank you.
All right. Goodbye.
Oh, wow. Okay, so, I mean, talk about, for me, this, for somebody who does something similar to what I do, it is nice to be able to hear how much work goes into it. Do I put in as much work? Well, that's for me to know and for you to find out. But for someone like Peter, who has trained himself and has rolled with the punches as they've come and has the kind of, for lack of a better word, clout that he has, you could hear the humility. He's still a person who's just doing what he loves to the best of his ability. We have just finished talking with Peter Okwuche of the BBC. That ends our interview segment on Weekend Nigeria for this week. We'll take a short break and we'll come back and sign off in a few minutes. Weekend Nigeria, Spirit of Nigeria Radio, positive Nigerian energy, bringing Nigerians in diaspora up to speed.
Spirit of Nigeria Radio, bringing Nigerians in diaspora up to speed.
Eba mi so fun sisi komo ilo mo je so wi pe faji gele lawo eba mi so fun sisi komo isalo ani fe mo je so wi pe faji gele lajo sisi jawo komo ilo dia omo de je mi ami da duro de mi ani ko gbe mi saya ko wa fi fe du saya mi amo den che mi di ami da di a jo wo ko mai lo amo den che mi ko gbe mi saya I see the sun in your eyes. I see the stars in your eyes. I see the
colors of the rainbow in